Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. Death is not only a hard topic to talk about, but to accept as well. We all cope with the death of loved ones in our own ways, but one of those ways is to write about grief and how to live after the sorrow. My guest today is Warren Kozak. He's author of Waving Goodbye, Life After Loss, available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Warren, go to Warren Kozak, K-O-Z-A-K, warrenkozak.com. And Warren, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Iron. It's a pleasure to be here with you. And the bagels.
Always the bagels. So to quote you, and this is a direct quote, "To those around me, my friends, my colleagues, even my daughter, I appear normal. But in one very fundamental way, I am not. The old me left with my wife. I'm not sure who this new person is. I am still evolving. But I will tell you this with absolute certainty. I am not the same person I was before January 1, 2018. It must have been quite an ordeal at the time. And I know you're still going through who the new Warren Kozak is. But can you give us some background as to writing the book?
Sure, Ira. It is a book I never expected to write. I'll start there. I've written a couple of other books completely different. I wrote a book about a Hasidic rabbi, and that gave me the opportunity to look at the Jewish world in Europe before World War II. And then I wrote something completely different. I wrote a biography of one of the most controversial Air Force generals in U.S. history, Curtis LeMay. I don't know if you remember him.
I remember Curtis LeMay. Yes,
right. Indeed. So they couldn't have been more different. And as I said, I wasn't expecting to write this. Right after my wife died, and that was on January 1st, 2018, people brought books. And I found almost every book to be impenetrable. They didn't help. I couldn't read them. Most of them written by psychologists, psychiatrists, grief counselors, and they may have helped other people. They did not help me. Because one of the factors that surprised me was how my brain function completely stopped, really. Some background here. My wife had a 4-year illness. During that illness, we were in hospitals a lot of the time dealing with doctors. We had, at the time, our daughter was in high school. She has since gone through college and is working now. But I was able to take care of my wife. I was able to take care of our daughter. I was able to deal with all of the doctors and the hospitals, and I have a full-time job. And I was able to do all that, mostly from the hospital room. When my wife died, my brain just went out to lunch, and that shocked me. I was not expecting that. So when I got all of these books that were written in a very, very academic style, I just couldn't read them. As I said, they didn't penetrate, and they didn't help. About 5 years after she died, I was looking at my diary. Do you keep a diary by any chance?
An informal one. I don't keep a daily diary.
Okay.
That makes sense.
In 1980, I was traveling so much for a job. I didn't know what city I was in. So I just started writing. I'm serious. I started writing down where I was just in case I needed to go back. And it became a habit. For some reason, I went back and looked at the diary for the last, I'd say, 4 months of her life, and then what happened immediately after. And I was surprised by it. I also received an email from a friend, and the email obviously struck a chord, and I put the entire email into the diary. I read that again, and I said, I called him up. I said, we have to sit down and have coffee. And we sat down. It was a beautiful October day, and I asked him to elaborate on his story. And This is a man. I might as well tell you the story. It's in the book, but it's I think it's important. This is a man I've known for a long time. He's had a 50-year marriage, three kids, three grown kids, very successful man. He's now retired. And I knew that he had a first marriage. And I knew that his oldest child is the child of his first wife. And I said, what was your first wife's name? I didn't even know. And he told me. And then I said, what happened? And he said, she died in childbirth, basically. He had a huge job here in New York. And you don't expect to hear things like this. It was a medical mistake. It happens. There are actually 1,000 women that die every year in the United States. We almost think of it as something from the 19th century, but it still can happen. He was lucky. So here was a guy with an infant daughter, a big job, and he was grieving. He luckily met a woman 6 months later who was able to take on this grieving widower, an infant child, and he has had a very successful marriage, a very successful life. But he said, throughout that time, something would come up and he couldn't figure it out. He said, I was sad. And there was no reason to be sad. And he has a friend who is a psychiatrist. And he said, am I a depressed person? He said, you're not depressed. You're just sad. And he said, even after all this time, even after 50 years, this really takes a hold over you and it has an impact. Now there's good news here, and it's good news for anyone who is going through this right now. It gets better. It does get better. I never thought I would say those words to you. I never thought I would say them out loud, because in that first year, the first 2 years, you think this is going to be the case forever. It's not. It does get better. But there are little things that help, little things that didn't help. And this is a long way to answer your question, Ira. And it's that I wrote the book in short chapters, short sentences for those people who are just going through this, so they can hopefully understand it. They can hopefully see that this is what happened to me. This is what worked. This is what didn't work. And it will get better. It does get better.
It's a practical approach that you take, in a sense. That sounds like a hard word, but it's practical in the sense that it's accessible to people. They can relate to it, as opposed to a lot of academic books and other tomes about how to cope or how to deal with a loved one. Because as I said in the introduction, everybody deals with grief in their own way. This was your way of dealing with it, but you offer hope to people, which is great. One of the important things too is that, to use a cliche, time heals all wounds. And a certain amount of time goes by, you never forget your loved one. You still get sad on occasion, but you also live in the moment, in the present as well.
I began to hate that term because it was such a cliche, and people would tell me that in the beginning, and I did not believe it. I could not believe it. The way I described it was, it's kind of a new time. I use a funny metaphor. I was fascinated with the I don't know if you remember, in the early astronaut days, with the Mercury program, there was a great big digital clock that was down at Cape Canaveral, and you would see it go 10, 9, 8, 7. And most people didn't realize that once the Redstone rocket took off with the astronaut on board, the clock actually continued in the other direction, 01, 02, 03. So they had an entire time for the mission. Once then it would stop when it touched down. I thought throughout her illness that it was clicking down to her death. And what I didn't realize was that the time continued in the other direction. And it was this new continuum of time that we are now living in. And it was the time, I called it the time after Lisa. Lisa was the name of my wife, obviously. And in that first year, it was dreadful. It gets better as you go forward. And little things helped. And people said, well, what helped? And one of the biggest things that helped was just putting on my socks every morning and going to work. And right. You kind of pretend you're a normal human being when you know you're not. And then eventually you become a normal human being again. But everyone is different. It can take some people longer, some people shorter amount of time. We're all different.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier that you wrote it in short sentences so people could grasp it and hopefully learn from it. How did you set up your table of contents then? Did you go chronologically or by subject matter? Or you just went the way you thought it would work best to explain it to people on how you dealt with such grief?
Good question. I start out, I guess you can say chronologically. I start out with what happened on January 1st, 2018, the moment my wife died. And even that shocked me because I had been anticipating it. I was told everything that was going to happen. The doctors were very clear and pretty much on target. And then when it actually happened, I was just dumbfounded. I was shocked. And I've heard this from other people as well. You can anticipate, you can try and prepare yourself. It will still shock. And
is that because of the finality of it?
That's a good question. I'm not even sure I can answer. The way I wrote about it in the book, and I will get back to you. I'm sorry, I went off on a tangent from your question.
Okay.
But the way I wrote about it in the book was, here was this person I knew better than anyone I have ever known in my life. That includes my parents, includes my siblings, includes my daughter. It is a connection unlike any I have ever had. At the same time, I was dealing with her illness. I was trying to take care of her. And then all of a sudden, she moves into this other realm. And it's a realm with unknowns. We don't know. This is the great mystery of life, right? People have been dealing with this since Genesis. And so I think it's that unknown that's part of it. Or it was for me, anyway.
Thank you. How did your Judaism help you in terms of coping with the death of your wife, the TAL, time after Lisa?
I was reluctant to talk about religion in this book because it is such a touchy subject. And there are, you know, I have friends, that span the spectrum. You know, I have friends that go to church and synagogue every day. I have friends that have never set foot in a church or synagogue.
Right.
So I didn't want to, offend anyone. And I think everyone's religious beliefs are very much their own. And I will respect anyone, you know, no matter what they are. It doesn't matter to me. However, near the end of the book, I realized death is so intertwined with religion, you cannot ignore it. You can't. So I did explain in a chapter, and I say at the top of the chapter, for anyone who has strong feelings about this, just skip to the next chapter now, but I am going to explain, you know, how it affected me. What surprised me here, and by the way, there have been previous books. I know there's a very famous book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, written by a rabbi. And I read that, and he was kind of wrestling with God. And a lot of people wrestle with God. C.S. Lewis wrote a book about, the famous English author wrote a book after his wife died. C.S. Lewis is a very famous Christian author. And he, you know, went through a period where he, I was even shocked at some of the things, you know, some of the way he wrote about some of the things he said about God. So with that in mind, what worked for me, and it doesn't work for everyone, was I found it a tremendous comfort in a lot of different ways. It gave me an order when I needed some order in my life. I also found that the Shiva, and we should talk about that, I think, that is the 7 days. And it, actually, the word Shiva is Hebrew for seven. It's the 7 days where people come to the house, and you don't realize how much you... This kind of forces you to act human again when you don't want to, when you want to just curl up in a ball and just go, you know, close the door and not just shut yourself off from the world. This forces you to go through the motions of being human. And what I write in the book is that I had the sense that I was acting through those days, and the role I was playing was normal me when I wasn't normal me at all. And it was, and I even knew, you know, people are coming in, you have to be social, you have to say thank you for coming, you have to, you know, talk to them a little bit. And our house was filled up every night. And I, by the way, felt terrible for people a couple of years later during COVID when they couldn't have that. I just couldn't imagine anything worse than that. You know, if my daughter and I had to come back from the synagogue after the service to an empty house, that would have been devastating. So the Shiva is an amazing process, and every religion has their own, you know, variants on this. You know, there are wakes. The Catholics have wakes. Every religion has some form of this, and it's necessary.
I already have an idea for your next book, which would be Death and Atheists, because you mentioned all these different religions have these various rituals, and yet what do you do if you're an atheist and your spouse or a loved one dies? How do you cope? And so that might be an interesting research project.
It might be, but I could not write that because I'm not an atheist.
So. No, I understand that, but you're a great writer and you have a great background. In fact, I'd like to talk a little bit just to, again, we're going to divert slightly just to give our audience a sense of your background as a writer.
Sure.
So tell us a little bit about your background as a writer. And
sure. Out of college, my first job was with ABC News. It's something I wanted to do since I was about 8 years old. I write, I think it's on my website, that I came home from school one day and turned on the TV, and I was probably looking for cartoons, and I found something called the Huntley Brinkley Report. Remember that?
See, now you've asked me four different things about, if I can remember Curtis LeMay, I can remember Huntley Brinkley. Chet Huntley, yes.
Well, it's such a pleasure to talk with you because everyone I work with is less than half my age. And I say these things and it goes right over there.
Oh, yeah. Well, just a reference back to Curtis LeMay and bombing him back to the Stone Age. But go ahead. Because that was one of the things he was known for at the time.
So I became hooked on this thing. I thought it was the most amazing thing that these two fellows, Huntley and Brinkley, this was the NBC Nightly News for anybody.
Chet Huntley and David Brinkley are the two.
Okay. Exactly. Right. They brought the entire world into my house, into my den in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in I guess it was the late 50s, early 60s. And I was fascinated by it, and I kind of thought this would be something really wonderful to do for the rest of my life. So I went with the idea that I was going to be working on the Huntley Brinkley show, and that never worked. I went to ABC instead, and Chet Huntley had passed away by the time I finished school, and David Brinkley had left NBC. Actually, he came to ABC. I worked with him once, I think. But anyway, I became a writer at ABC, and I was a reporter for a time at NPR, and I worked as a journalist. And then for the last 25 years, I kind of saw the direction of TV news, and it was going in a direction I didn't care for that much. It wasn't what it was when I started. And I have worked for the last 25 years for one individual who is one of the more fascinating people I've ever met. And he is very involved in the Jewish world, but he's doing all sorts of other things. He has a foundation that is fast-tracking Alzheimer's drugs. He has his own museum here in New York, and I get to work on a lot of different things, and especially things I care about deeply, which in this case is the Jewish world. I need to say something else about this man. When my wife got sick, my boss travels a lot, and I travel with him pretty often. And when she got sick, he said, "I want you to stop traveling. Work remotely. I'm going to be too nervous if something happens to her while you're with me." Because of that, I was able to be with my wife for the last 3 years of her life. I was able to be with her. I would be working in the hospital room and typing out things. But you don't find bosses like that. And I have to say also how grateful I was that, as bad as things were, I was a lot luckier than a lot of other people. I had a boss like that. I had support. I had an insurance plan that paid for most of her illness, health insurance. And some people don't get that. And I could not imagine something as bad as you losing someone and then also, you know, depleting your bank account, everything you've saved up for. That's horrible.
Yeah. When you finished the book, A, did your boss read it, and did your daughter read it, and what were their reactions if they did read it?
I gave it to my daughter after it was a fait accompli. I had actually started, and I thought, oh, this is not really fair. You know, I should give it to her. And we should also talk about my relationship with my daughter. I think, you know, that's fairly important. She was pleased with it. And what I also did in the book was I ended it with something she wrote. And I said, throughout all of this, everything I've written, it had to do with how it affected me. But here's someone who lost her mother. It's very different, you know, losing a mother and losing a mother when you're a teenager and losing a spouse. I didn't understand exactly how she felt. And then she showed me something. She was then a sophomore in college. And about a couple months after Lisa died, she wrote something for a college class. And I was stunned by it. It was absolutely gorgeous, just a beautiful piece of writing. And I put it in at the very end of the book. It is her memory of what happened in a really beautiful text that moved me greatly. I will also say the three of us, my wife, myself, my daughter, our daughter, were a really close unit, and it was a really good, you know, each of us had a different role with our daughter, and it worked perfectly. And then I didn't understand, and she didn't understand the how a family of three is devastated when one person leaves and it becomes a family of two. You know, it's a high percentage, 33%. So. Mm-hmm. And at first we were kind of stunned looking at each other and thinking, okay, now what? I will say we have grown so close, and we have a really, really good relationship. My only concern, my only worry, and it's her worry too, is what happens if something happens to me, what happens to her? She would feel very alone in the world, and she worries a lot about that. So I keep trying to tell her I'm going to the gym every day, and I'm trying to be careful. I don't try not to do anything stupid. That doesn't always happen. But
did she know that you were going to put her essay in your book?
I asked her permission actually for that.
Okay.
Yeah. And she thought about it. She thought about it for a couple of days, and then she came back. She said, okay, fine.
Mm-hmm. And I come back to a question you didn't answer because I always remember everything. And that is, did your boss get a chance to read the book?
No, I did not show it to him.
Okay. I was just curious because it was so nice to be able to have your time with your wife the last 3 years.
Oh, I told him that. And when I gave him the book, I wrote that in a little message to him. So
before I let you go, what's the main takeaway you'd like people to get from your book? There's so much in your book, and as I mentioned earlier, it's a candid, honest, and approachable guide to dealing with the death of a spouse. But what would you like people to take away mostly from reading your book? And again, it's called Waving Goodbye.
Ira, I think it's what I said earlier. And even as I am about to say it again, I'm thinking, I'm not sure I would have believed it myself in those first few months, that things will get better. They do get better. I wrote how there was a time, there was one day this past fall, I was walking, it was just a gorgeous fall day. I was walking down Madison Avenue. I have, AirPods in my ear, and I really depend on music a lot. And I just heard a gorgeous song. I was listening to a gorgeous piece of music. It was sunny. It was lovely. People were actually smiling. You don't see that too often anymore. And I thought, damn, this is pretty good. This is okay. I'm doing okay. And I was enjoying the afternoon. I was enjoying myself. I was happy to be alive.
I just thought of something based on what you were just talking about. Was there one piece of music that helped you throughout that period of time dealing with grief? Was there one, whether it was classical or some sort of sentimental song or upbeat song? Was there one piece of music? Because music does help in terms of stirring the emotions. Was there one that just hit you the right way?
There were several. And there was one especially. I write about how I was shocked at how much sad music there is and how much music actually delves into this topic. And I guess I had heard some of these songs before, and I never really, well, you know what? I was going to say I never heard the words. Of course I heard the words. I heard the lyrics, but they didn't affect me the same way because I hadn't lost anyone. You change. You're a very different person. There is a woman named Eva Cassidy. I don't know if you've heard of her. She has it's a very sad story. She was a singer, and she had cancer in her 30s and died, and not that many people knew about her. And someone on the BBC started playing her music, and it went right to the top of the charts. This is after she passed away. And in the movie Love Actually, they use one of her songs in the movie. And she has become so famous after she died. There are a couple songs, what I write in the book is, I dare you to try and listen to one of her songs with dry eyes. You can't. That was something there's a funny story. My daughter got me on Spotify. And if you know how Spotify works, if you're listening to a certain kind of music, they have an algorithm that will lead you to other songs you might like. And they gave me what I thought were these Norwegian women singers that I was just blown away by. I was just knocked out by them. And I'm listening to them and one after another. And I have a playlist of what I thought were these Norwegian singers. And I was talking to my next door neighbor who was from Copenhagen. And I mentioned it. She said, I'd like to hear them. And so I played some and she looks at me like, idiot, they're not Norwegian, they're Swedish. I didn't even realize that there were two different languages. Idiot than I am. So I now call them the formerly Norwegian singers. I just want to say the other thing in the book is some funny things happen throughout this ordeal, and I put them in too. And it's life. You can't, there are bad things that happen. There are terrible things that happen. Some people were magnificent and supportive. Some people were kind of jerks. I thought. And also some funny things happened. So, you know, I put them in.
Well, that's a life. Great way. That's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Warren Kozak. He's author of Waving Goodbye, Life After Loss, available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. For everything about Warren, go to Warren Kozak, K-O-Z-A-K, warrenkozak.com. And Warren, thanks for being on the show.
Ira, no, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.